It's Bigler's World, right here on Sun Sounds, Arizona. And I'm Jim Bigler for the next hour. I'm going to be reading all kinds of kids' magazines, got these kids' articles all over the place, little National Geographic kids. I don't think I've done that in weeks. I'm going to have to do it today. That's all there is to it. What other stuff? Some Ranger Rick, maybe. Let's start with news for kids. Bum, bum. Says right here in the title, Australia bans social media until age 16. Yikes. Where did this come from? Canberra, Australia. Australia has passed a law that aims to prevent people younger than 16 from using social media. The law is meant to protect young people, but some people say it could create more problems than it solves. The law will go into effect in a year. Starting in January, Australia will test ways to carry out the law. Under the new law, social media companies like Meta, which owns Facebook and Instagram, and TikTok, must take reasonable steps to prevent anyone under 16 from creating an account. If the companies do not follow the law, they could be fined up to $32 million. Those are U.S. dollars, by the way. The law doesn't affect all social media. YouTube is not included because it's often used in schools. Last Thursday, Australia's Senate passed the Social Media Minimum Age Bill, 34 votes to 19. Australia's Prime Minister, Anthony Albanese, strongly supports the new law. He says it may not be perfect, but that it is needed to protect young people from the negative effects of social media. Most people in Australia seem to agree. Recent posts show that 77% of people in Australia are in favor of the law. People are worried about how social media can hurt young people's mental health. Many people have heard stories about young people who've been bullied online and later hurt themselves. But not everyone agrees that the new law is a good idea. Some people believe the law will make it harder for young people to connect with others who can support them. Others worry that the social media ban will push young people toward less safe parts of the internet. One of the biggest concerns is how the social media companies will figure out how old their users are. The law says the companies must give people a way to prove their age without sending in a government ID, but it's not clear how this might work. The demand that the companies collect even more information raises worries about the privacy of young people. Critics say that the government rushed to make the new law and that it hasn't been thought out well. The government will take the next 12 months to decide on many of the specific rules of the new law and how they will work. Social media companies have criticized the law. They believe the government should have figured out how the law would work before passing it. Still, most companies say that they will try to follow the rules. Around the world, there are serious concerns about the effects of social media on young people. In 2023, U.S. Surgeon General Vivek Murthy said that social media should come with a health warning. Other countries have also taken steps to limit social media use by young people. In France, people under 15 cannot use social media without permission from a parent. Countries like the UK and Norway are considering similar laws. Some U.S. states have passed laws limiting social media for young people, though these laws have been challenged in court. And the next article here. On Bigler's World, sticking with news for kids, COF-999, a special new material for capturing carbon. Scientists in California have created a new material that can remove large amounts of carbon dioxide, or CO2, from the air. The fluffy yellow powder works faster than other materials and can be used over and over again. The new material could play an important part in the fight against climate change. Then has a thing about carbon dioxide in the air. Carbon dioxide is a gas that's naturally found in the air. But human activity, especially the burning of fossil fuels, has greatly increased the amount of CO2 in our atmosphere. This buildup of CO2 is one of the main causes of global warming. To deal with this problem, scientists say large amounts of CO2 must be removed from the atmosphere. Even though there's too much carbon dioxide in our atmosphere, CO2 is just a small part of the gases that make up air. It makes it tricky to remove. If you could somehow take a bag of air, split it into different gases that make it up, and put those gases into 2,500 tiny bags, and I want you to do this, only one of these tiny bags will have carbon dioxide in it. Okay, back to the article. Currently, many people around the world are working on ways of removing carbon from the air and storing it. This is often called direct air capture, DAC or DAC. DAC technology is still being developed, but normally during the process, air is pulled across a material that can remove CO2 from it. One common material is limestone. Later, the material is heated to carefully release the CO2 so it can be stored safely underground. But the current methods of doing this are expensive and don't capture much CO2. COF, the new material created by scientists at UC Berkeley, is a different story. Under a powerful microscope, the yellow powder looks like it's made of tiny balls. Each tiny ball has an incredible number of holes in it. Those holes allow air to pass through the balls. Attached to these balls are lots of little ammonines. An ammonine is a special chemical mixture related to ammonia. The ammonines are great at grabbing carbon dioxide molecules from the air and holding on to them. To test COF999, the scientists filled a small tube, about as big as a drinking straw, with the powder. They then piped air from outside the lab through the tube for 20 days. Though there was CO2 in the air outside, the air that came out of the tube had no carbon dioxide at all. The discovery was exciting for scientists. It was this Dr. Omar Yagi. He says, "I see the solution to the climate problem right there in our hands." COF999 has many advantages. It captures CO2 about 10 times faster than other DAC materials. Researchers say that half a pound of the powder can pull as much CO2 from the air as a tree can. But unlike trees, COF99 can capture CO2 even when it's dark outside. To get COF99 to release the carbon, it just needs to be heated around 140 degrees Fahrenheit. That's much cooler than most other DAC materials, meaning it will take less energy to collect the CO2. The materials needed to make COF999 don't cost much. Perhaps most importantly, COF99 can be reused over and over again. The scientists have already tested reusing the material up to 300 times. They believe it could probably be reused thousands of times. The researchers, still working on COF99, they hope that it will soon be able to remove twice as much carbon as it does now. The next big challenge is figuring out how to use COF99 in a direct air capture system. The machine will have to be designed so that the powder won't blow away when the air is pulled through the machine. The scientists believe that COF999 will be ready to use in DAC systems in about 2 years. And at the bottom they have a thing here. Did you know the discovery of COF99 didn't just happen? Really? Graduate student Zihu Zhu, he spent years doing hundreds of experiments, testing materials with different kinds of structures before the researchers finally came up with COF999. Ba-doop, boop. Okay, let's do one more article from News for Kids. Ba-dum, ba-dum. At 74, world's oldest bird lays another egg. Yikes. From Midway Atoll. Atoll, however you pronounce that. The world's oldest known wild bird is an albatross named Wisdom. She's around 74 years old and has recently returned to her nesting place in the Midway Atoll. Wisdom may be old, but she's still active. She has just laid her first egg in 4 years. The Midway Atoll is made of two small islands in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, about halfway between the U.S. and Asia. The island is home to about 3 million seabirds who return there every year to mate, lay their eggs, and raise their chicks. About 1.3 million of these birds are Laysian albatrosses like Wisdom. Albatrosses are huge birds that spend much of their life at sea. With their wings spread out, albatrosses measure around 6.5 feet from wingtip to wingtip. Midway is an important place for albatrosses and an important place for scientists who want to study them. One of the ways scientists can study birds is by banding them. Putting a small numbering band on the leg of a bird helps scientists tell which bird is which. It also makes it easier to keep track of what happens among the birds. Over 275,000 albatrosses have been banded on Midway since 1936. Wisdom was first banded in 1956. Her band number is Z333. At the time, scientists believed she was about 5 years old, since that's the youngest that albatrosses can lay eggs. Most Laysian albatrosses live for only 12 to 40 years, but at 74 years old, Wisdom has lived long, so long that her band has had to be changed 6 times. When albatrosses lose a partner, they remain partners for life. Oh, when they choose them, not lose them. or death. But Wisdom's extreme age means that she has outlived several partners. For many years, Wisdom's partner was a bird called, see if I can pronounce this, Akikamaya. Whatever, that bird hasn't been seen for several years. This year, Wisdom has found a new partner. What's more, on November 26th, Wisdom laid another egg. Because raising a chick requires so much time and energy, many albatrosses lay eggs every other year. But until recently, Wisdom had a streak of laying eggs for several years in a row. Scientists say Wisdom has laid 50 to 60 eggs in her lifetime, and about 30 to 36 of those eggs have hatched. Her last chick hatched in 2021 when Wisdom was 70 years old. Wisdom and her new partner are taking turns sitting on the egg. If the egg hatches, which could happen in February, they will take turns caring for the chick and flying out to sea for food. They will have to do that for about 7 months until the chick can fly. Albatrosses normally return to the same nesting spot every year. Wisdom's current nest is near her earlier nests. In 2017, scientists spotted one of Wisdom's children in a nest nearby. Because Wisdom has been laying eggs for so long, she could have her chicks and the chicks of her chicks all around her. And there may soon be one more to add to the list. And there a little did you know at the bottom here. Adult albatrosses spend a lot of their lives flying over the sea, resting from time to time on the water to eat. Wisdom has probably flown around 3.5 million miles in her lifetime. And next article here on Brigler's World. Let's do another publication, Science News Explores. This article entitled, 50 Years On, Lucy Offers Lessons for Achieving Fossil Fame. Discovered in 1974, her skeleton kicked off a new way of thinking about human evolution, says Bruce Bauer, who wrote this particular article. One of the biggest superstars in human history lies in the National Museum of Ethiopia. Here in Addis Ababa sit the fragile remains of the world's most celebrated human ancestor, Lucy. Once she was a hardy survivor in a harsh landscape, now her partial skeleton gets round-the-clock protection in a specially constructed safe. Nearly 3.2 million years ago, this ancient female roamed East Africa's landscape. She was not large, standing a bit over 3 feet tall and weighing no more than about 66 pounds. But she had a huge impact on the story of human evolution. Today, half a century after her partial skeleton was found, people everywhere know Lucy. Her discovery in 1974 ushered in a new way of thinking about human evolution. Many paleontologists at the time viewed the process as a straight line. One ancient Homo species led directly to the next until the emergence of present-day people, they thought. But Lucy's appearance muddied this idea. Some of her features were very human-like. They included her curved spine. Her traits were ape-like, including long arms and a brain no larger than a chimp's. Together, these traits pointed to a more tree-like picture of human evolution. In that scheme, multiple species branched off in different directions. Some died out completely. Others led to the Homo genus and, eventually, to us. Lucy's mix of features has sparked many new questions. How did two-legged walking emerge? When did humans' large brains evolve? Importantly, Lucy's discovery kicked off a series of fossil finds. Together, they filled the scientific picture of her species. By 1978, Lucy was declared the founding member of a new species. It was named Australopithecus. There's another word, afarensis. There it is. Australopithecus. The last 50 years have turned up many other fossils from human ancestors. Collectively, such ancestors are known as hominids, or more often, hominins. But none have come close to Lucy in name recognition. A look back at her story reveals tips for how to rise to fossil fame. Get buried, it says, but not too deep. In 1974, Donald Johnson and Tom Gray were on a fossil hunt in a remote part of Ethiopia. Johansson was an American paleoanthropologist. There it is. Gray was a graduate student who worked with him. On the morning of November 24th, they were mapping and surveying, couldn't get that word out, promising spots. They walked through a gully at a site known as Hadar. Then Johansson noticed a forearm bone sticking out of the ground. A closer look confirmed that the bone came from a hominid. The pair gingerly dug out many more pieces of the bone from the loose soil nearby. After 2 more weeks, the researchers and their colleagues had uncovered several hundred bone fragments. It was a big haul. Often just one ancient skull cap or partial jaw can require weeks or months of careful excavation. From those finds, the team pieced together 47 bones. They formed a small fossil skeleton, about 40% complete. It was the most complete early hominid skeleton at that time, by a lot. Geology had worked in Johansson's and Gray's favor. Lucy's remains were not found where she died. Flooding had carried away her body probably shortly after death. It was washed into a sandy channel. A quickly forming lake would have buried the body. The moist sediment kept her bones in relatively good shape, and the fossils were pretty close to the surface. So later, once the lake had dried up, the bones began to emerge from the sandy ground, just enough to get the fossil partly started. Hanging out with the right fossil crowd. This same land yielded many other hominid fossils from 1973 to 1977. Several would turn out to belong to the same species. This confirmed Lucy was part of a larger A. afarensis population. Other fossil finds helped scientists distinguish between 2 related species. Lucy's East African species was one. The other was Australopithecus africanus, previously identified in South Africa. Over time, fossils from several East African sites have been determined to be A. afarensis. Hadar has yielded about 90% of the nearly 600 fossils so far attributed to this species. Hadar's geology also gave Lucy a big advantage in the ancient dating game. Radioactive dating, that is. 3 Hadar sediment formations hold A. afarensis remains. Each also contains layers of volcanic matter and ash. Radioactive argon in that volcanic material decays at a steady rate. Measuring this rate of radioactivity decay allowed scientists to estimate the fossil's age. Lucy lived an estimated 3.2 million years ago. Her species at Hadar and elsewhere existed from about 3.9 million to 3 million years ago. So Lucy was an especially early hominid, the oldest known at the time of her discovery. Make a good name for yourself. Lucy's worldwide fame also was boosted by a catchy, memorable name. Johansson and Gray's discovery was a momentous occasion. When they returned to camp with what looked like pieces of a hominid skeleton, the whole team celebrated. As they partied, a tape recorder played the Beatles' song "Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds" over and over. The tune's psychedelic lyrics echoed through the surreal events of that day. Joya's partners started calling the newfound fossil Lucy. The modern name, familiar to people around the world, gave Lucy a big boost towards fossil stardom. Her naming was far from typical. Most fossil hominid specimens get named for the place where they were found. Consider the tongue child. T-A-U-N-G, Tong. This three-year-old's fossil skull was found by miners at South Africa's Tong Quarry. It was unearthed in 1924, a full 50 years before Lucy. And its discovery, researchers generally agree, launched the modern era of fossil hominid studies. The Tong skull was used to describe A. africanus, a new species. It turned researchers' attention away from Asia and towards Africa as the birthplace of hominids. And its shape hinted that early hominids adopted a two-legged gait before evolving big brains. But despite its scientific importance, the Tong child never achieved Lucy's public fame. Lucy goes by other names. Her formal scientific designation is AL-288-1. Ethiopians today refer to the remains as Dinknesh. In a regional language, this means "you are marvelous." But on the world stage, the Hadar female is best known as Lucy. Get people talking. Though Lucy's skeleton is incomplete, it revealed some of her species' anatomy. These clues were enough to reshape long-standing debates about hominid evolution, but they didn't supply easy answers. 5 decades later, these disputes continue. At the time of Hadar Fine, one family dominated anthropology, the Leakeys. Lewis and Mary Leakey and their son Richard had many ideas about human evolution. Lewis Leakey thought that all human evolution occurred within the Homo genus. One Homo species led to the next, he argued. They didn't branch or lead to dead-end lines. In this view, Australopithecine, such as Tong Child, represented extinct ape species. Big brains powered the rise of the Homo genus, the Leakeys argued. That started in Africa perhaps 3 million years ago. Eventually, it led to today's humans. Lucy challenged their idea. Here was a body built for human-like walking, topped by an ape-like brain. Johansson suggested her species marked a dramatic split in hominid evolution. A. afrensis evolved in one direction, he proposed, into later Australopithecines. It also evolved in another direction into the Homo genus. He and many others still hold that view today. Lucy's partial skeleton triggered other disputes as well. Her spine and legs were adapted for an upright gait. That might seem even more likely that she was a direct Homo ancestor, but she also had relatively long arms and curved fingers. These resembled those of a tree-climbing ape. So how did Lucy prefer to get around? Researchers have debated about whether her species spent time in trees or mainly stayed on the ground. Some bone data suggests that she had exceptional upper body strength that could support a controversial proposal that she fell to her death from high up in a tree. But another A. afrensis fossil's find suggests a two-legged stance would have kept Lucy on the ground. If so, she probably died from some other cause. And there's make the right scientific friends. Lucy attracted big-time researchers right from the start. All that attention from well-known admirers helped her scientific status soar. Johansson was Lucy's first champion. He arrived at Hadar in 1972 as part of an international team of fossil-hunting superstars. The team worked at the site for years and excavated many Hadar fossils. Johansson went on to found the Institute of Human Origins, now at Arizona State University in Tempe. Johansson also recruited a young researcher to help analyze the ancient bones. Tim White would go on to have a bright career as a paleoanthropologist. He helped Johansson identify Lucy and other nearby fossils as a new species. Years later, White helped excavate a 4.4 million-year-old partial hominid skeleton known as Ardi. Like Lucy, Ardi also shook up the human family tree. Johansson took a very active role in bringing science to the public eye. He co-wrote a book in 1981, Lucy, The Beginnings of Humankind. It brought her worldwide attention. The same year, he debated Richard Leakey on television, moderated by Walter Cronkite, an extremely trusted and popular newscaster. That year, too, Johansson met anthropologist William Kimball. Kimball became the best Homo sapiens friend Lucy and her kind could have ever asked for. Kimball took charge of a new phase of field work at Hadar in the 1990s. For the next 30 years, he raised money for, organized, and directed excavations of A. afarensis. He detailed differences between hominid species and what they meant for primate evolution. Kimball and Johansson also argued that Lucy is a direct ancestor of the Homo genus. During his televised debate with Richard Leakey, Johansson showed a drawing of his proposed hominid family tree. Leakey scrawled a question mark over it. Decades later, the shape of this tree and Lucy's place in it remain controversial. No matter how these questions play out, one thing is clear. Lucy's trip from a Hadar gully to an Ethiopian museum vault has been a key piece of the journey to understand the origins of humankind. 50 years after stopping a pair of fossil hunters in their tracks, Lucy's star power still shines bright. Okay, let's do at least one more article from Science News. Science News Explorers. What do we got here? Under the microscope, this biologist sees a tiny jungle. Sally Waring studies tiny life forms called protists, as in P-R-O-T-I-S-T-S, protists, and she captures them on camera. Maria Temming wrote this article, goes like this. To Sally Waring, protists are an absolutely underrated type of wildlife. And this is her talking. She studies these creatures at Earlham University in Norwich, England. She says, protists are very charismatic and interesting. Among this richly diverse group of mostly single-celled eukaryotes, creatures whose DNA is packed in a nucleus, some are hunters and others are prey. Some live in colonies, others alone. Some even have mating rituals or build themselves tiny structures to live in.
There's all this stuff going on that we usually associate with more complex animals,
Waring says.
It's just not as well studied because it's harder to study.
Waring's research investigates the genetic blueprints or genomes of protists.
From the genomes, we can get information about what these organisms are and how they live, what they need to eat, if they secrete things into the environment, that kind of information,
Waring says. That could help her explore more than the largely uncharted biodiversity of protists. It could put more familiar types of life into better context, too.
Protists make up most of eukaryotic diversity,
Waring says.
So if we want to understand how different eukaryotic groups evolved, including animals, plants, fungi, and important parasites, then we need to understand what's going on in protists.
In this interviewing, Waring shares reflections on her experience with Science News Explorers. Okay, during my undergrad, is this her talking here?
During my undergrad, I randomly took a course on protists, and I just was blown away. We got to look at different protists through the microscopes, and I got to see organisms such as Valvox and Paramecium and amoebas. I'd never thought about these organisms before. I didn't know anything about them, and I couldn't believe how much complexity in behavior and lifestyle was exhibited by the organisms that were only one cell big, or in the case of Volvox, a colony of cells.
What is your favorite protist?
I do like Valvox, mainly because it's one of the first I saw and is just really beautiful. It's big enough that you can see it with the naked eye because it's a colony. If you find it blooming in a pond, you can just hold that water up to the light and you'll be able to see them all moving around. I now work on a group of protists called Eugalnosia. They're also up there in terms of favorites. They come in a range of colors and sizes, and they do all sorts of different things. One of my favorites is called Phacus, P-H-A-C-U-S. It looks like a falling leaf when it moves around. It's really beautiful.
How did your Instagram pond life start?
Well, I started it during my PhD after my conversation that I had with the man I'm now married to. He was asking me about my research on protests and asked me, why are you even interested in these things? And I was saying, they look amazing. They do all of these cool behaviors. And he said, it sounds like they would make great television. After that, I spent some time figuring out how to do the photography with my iPhone through a microscope, and I started going out and collecting samples around New York City, putting them under the microscope and just filming things that I liked. How do you foster creativity? Well, I go and I sit at the microscope and I just spend some time looking at things. If I need to break from the computational work that I do, I also find talking to colleagues really valuable. If I'm working on a problem that's giving me trouble, sometimes I just get up and go for a little walk outside or even around the building. Sometimes the project's just kind of turning over in my head and an idea comes to mind.
What advice do you wish you'd been given when you were younger?
Well, sometimes when I tell people I'm a scientist, they react like it might be boring, like it's just a lot of crunching numbers, it's a bit of that. But I think people underestimate the level of creativity that's important in science. I understand that too. I didn't go into science until later in my undergrad because I was kind of under the impression that science wasn't that creative, but it really is. That's probably my favorite bit about what I do, that I get to think about problems and come up with the best way to interrogate them. I would like to tell even myself a few years ago, don't feel like you always have to follow the rules. Try to be more creative in how you think about tools and solving problems and even thinking of hypotheses. Okay, let us go to another publication. Let's do some Student News Daily. Got an article here, Large Mysterious Drones Spotted Over New Jersey Neighborhoods. Let's see, who did this article? Did they tell me here? Tina Kelly from New Jersey and NJ.com. For more than 2 weeks, New Jersey residents have reported seeing mysterious drones hovering over their homes and neighborhoods at night in the northern part of the state. The drones, sometimes traveling in groups, have been spotted nightly in some areas, but law enforcement officials have been unable to provide an explanation for the large number of sightings. The FBI is taking the lead in the investigation and has asked the public's tips to determine if the drones pose a threat to residents. Who is this? Spokeswoman Amy J. Thorensen said Wednesday. She says, unfortunately, we don't have many answers, and we don't want to guess or hypothesize about what's going on. We are doing all we can to figure it out. The drones have disrupted a medevac helicopter picking up a patient and led to FAA drone flight restrictions over the Trump National Golf Club in Somerset County and Picatinny Arsenal in Morris County. The FBI said it requested the restrictions out of an abundance of caution. Here's what we know about the drone sighting so far. On November 18th, police began investigating reports of large numbers of drones hovering at night in Morris County in northern New Jersey. Reports have been filed with the police about drones in multiple municipalities in Morris County. Authorities in Hillsborough and Branchburg in Somerset County and communities in Warren County have also received reports. Social media reports about sightings in other towns have been plentiful, including numerous reports in Hunterdon, Monmouth, and Sussex counties. I hope you're writing this all down. The Warren County Prosecutor's Office issued a statement Wednesday acknowledging recent drone activity observed in Warren County. Prosecutors asked for residents' assistance in documenting drone sightings, especially those that involve critical infrastructures. There have been reports of sightings near Merrill Creek Reservoir in Harmony in Warren County. A resident says the drones appear in large numbers and seem to hover in the same area night after night. Some of the drones have also been unusually large, according to the reports. One Morris County resident reported seeing 8 drones at once near Black River Middle School in Chester. Another reported seeing 15 over a 3-hour period in Morris County. Some of the drones have been described as appearing to be the size of a car or a small plane.
The FBI confirmed last week it is investigating the sightings. Local law enforcement officials said the drones are not a threat to the residents. So what are possible explanations for the sightings? It remains unclear if the large number of drone sightings are related or if there is a single explanation for all of the devices spotted hovering over New Jersey. Some people theorize the drones are being used by criminals to case houses for robberies. Others suggest that they are being used by possible terrorists. Law enforcement officials have not said if any of those theories are plausible. Theories about the drones belong to hostile foreign powers being used for political intrigue or being controlled by aliens abound on social media. Pramod Abhichandani, he's a professor who directs the Advanced Air Mobility Lab at New Jersey Institute of Technology in Newark. He doesn't buy those theories. He says, to me, the simplest explanation is the correct explanation. He believes the drones probably belong to commercial or U.S. military operators. Whatever entity owns the drones would likely have significant money and staff to fly so many drones for so many hours for so many days, he said. That's especially true when flying drones in a group known as swarms, which is technically challenging, says Abhichandani. These are companies in New Jersey. There are companies, there it is, in New Jersey, that are defense contractors that do swarming of drones. Drone science fundamentals, class at NJIT. There are enough smart people now in the world, in the U.S. and in New Jersey, that if they really want to, they can start experimenting with swarms of drones. If the drones were watching houses for future crimes, as some have suggested, or being used by hostile foreign entities, they likely would not be so loud or brightly lit, he said. It would be extremely careless on the part of people who are working for foreign powers to just expose themselves like that, Abhichandani said. It takes an incredible amount of competence to do something nefarious with drones. FBI officials did not respond to questions about whether law enforcement officials have attempted to capture drones that appear to hover over the same areas nightly in New Jersey. Shooting down a drone is a federal crime, and it can be dangerous to those in the area, drone experts say. Okay, let us go over to Frontiers for Young Minds. This article entitled, Harnessing the Sun's Power to Turn Water into Fuel. Takashi Hisatomi wrote this article. Could water be the secret ingredient for future energy? Water, everyone knows, that is important for things like drinking, cooking, and keeping plants alive, right? But if we told you that this seemingly simple, tasteless, colorless liquid could be the key to powering cars, homes, industries, and maybe even entire cities in the future. This is not just a wild idea. It is a real scientific breakthrough called photocatalytic water splitting, in which scientists use sunlight to transform water into a clean, green fuel. Fossil fuels like coal, oil, and natural gas have powered our world for centuries, providing the energy needed for everything from lighting and heating our homes to running our appliances and electronic devices. However, burning fossil fuels releases a significant amount of carbon dioxide, or CO2, and other pollutants into the atmosphere. These gases trap heat, leading to global warming and climate change, which are causing an increase in extreme weather events, rising sea levels, and widespread damage to the environment. And climate change and air pollution are even making some people sick. On top of that, fossil fuels are not limitless resources. As we continue to extract them from the earth and use them, they are becoming harder to find and more expensive to produce. These problems have created an urgent need for greener, sustainable energy sources that can provide a steady supply of energy without harming the environment. Solar energy, wind power, and biofuels are all part of the solution, but one of the most promising alternatives is hydrogen fuel, particularly when it is produced in an environmentally friendly way. The promise of hydrogen fuel. Hydrogen is the most abundant element in the universe, and it has great potential as a clean fuel. To generate energy from hydrogen, it is fed into a device called a fuel cell. You can think of a fuel cell as kind of a battery that never runs out as long as it has a supply of hydrogen. Inside a fuel cell, hydrogen reacts with oxygen to produce electricity. Specifically, hydrogen molecules are split into protons and electrons. The electrons travel through a circuit, creating an electric current, while the protons combine with oxygen molecules and electrons coming back from the circuit to form water molecules, the only byproduct. This makes hydrogen fuel incredibly clean and environmentally friendly, offering a solution to reduce greenhouse gas emissions significantly. But first things first, where do you get the hydrogen? The way most hydrogen is produced today relies on natural gas, which is a fossil fuel. Through several steps, natural gas is heated with steam to produce hydrogen and CO2, so this process still adds to fossil fuel use and greenhouse gas emissions. To make green hydrogen, we need to produce it using renewable energy sources, not fossil fuels. This is where water and sunlight come in. By using sunlight to split water molecules into hydrogen and oxygen, we can produce hydrogen in a way that is both sustainable and environmentally friendly. This method is called photocatalytic water splitting. Photo means light, and catalytic describes a substance that speeds up a chemical reaction like water splitting. Photocatalytic water splitting could someday transform our energy system by providing a virtually limitless supply of clean fuels. As a fuel, green hydrogen can be used in many ways, such as powering cars and homes, or as an important part of industrial processes. It can also help to store solar energy as hydrogen fuel. The energy can be used later when the sun is not shining. Imagine a future in which cars run on hydrogen fuel, producing only water as exhaust, or where entire cities are powered by hydrogen produced from sunlight and water, without releasing any smog or greenhouse gases. This is the potential future that photocatalytic water splitting aims to achieve. But how does it work? Photocatalytic water splitting uses sunlight to break down water H2O into its basic components, hydrogen H2 and oxygen O2. The key to this process is using materials known as photocatalysts. These materials can absorb sunlight and use that energy to break the chemical bonds in water molecules. Photocatalysts are usually made from semiconductor materials like solar cells that can efficiently harness solar energy, but they need to be stable enough to work properly in water. There are several types of photocatalytic systems. One common approach is to use photocatalysts in a powder form, mixed into water in a big, clear tank. When the sunlight hits the water, the photocatalyst particles absorb the light and generate the energy needed to split the water molecules. Another approach involves using thin films of photocatalysts coated on various surfaces. The films are usually submerged in shallow trays filled with water and placed in direct sunlight to produce hydrogen. In either system, the hydrogen that is produced rises to the surface and can be collected using a series of tubes or gas collection chambers, and it is stored in tanks for later use. Each system has its own advantages and challenges. For example, powdered photocatalysts can be easily mixed into large volumes of water, making it possible to evenly distribute the photocatalytic particles at a high enough concentration to absorb sunlight and to quickly release the gases that are produced. However, collecting and reusing the powdered catalysts can be difficult. Thin films, on the other hand, are easier to handle and reuse, but they have to be designed very carefully to make sure they receive enough sunlight. Building a photocatalytic system. Because thin films are easier to use and can be reused, we decided to create a system based on that method. We hope to design a system that could work on a large scale and out in the real world instead of a lab. These qualities are necessary if we wish to use photocatalytic systems to produce enough hydrogen to meet some of the world's energy demands and help reduce our reliance on fossil fuels. In our research, we coated photocatalysts onto large glass sheets. These photocatalyst sheets were then assembled into panels that look kind of like solar panels you have probably seen in fields or on people's houses. We set up the panels outdoors where they could receive plenty of sunlight and added water. When sunlight hits these panels, the photocatalysts absorb the light and generate the energy needed to split water molecules into hydrogen and oxygen, which are both gases at room temperature. We used tubes and storage tanks to collect the hydrogen gas produced by our system, and we released the oxygen into the atmosphere. One of the key aspects of building photocatalytic water splitting systems is that they can be used in real life, is ensuring that they can withstand the weather. To test this, outdoor experiments are better than lab experiments because they expose the panels to varying weather conditions, from intense sunlight to rain and wind, and from scorching summer to freezing winter. Our initial experiments have been very promising, showing that our system can produce hydrogen efficiently under real-world conditions. This is an exciting step toward making photocatalytic water splitting a useful way to produce lots of hydrogen for everyone to use. Important work remains. While our initial results are promising, several big challenges must still be addressed before photocatalytic water splitting can be used on a large scale. One big challenge is finding the right materials to efficiently absorb sunlight and catalyze the water splitting reaction. Currently, even the best photocatalysts can convert only about 1 to 2% of the sunlight they receive into hydrogen. To make this technology affordable, we need to increase the efficiency to at least 10%. With this improved efficiency, the ground area needed to meet our energy demand, this is much larger than the world's largest solar plant in United Arab Emirates, and even larger than the area of Japan or United Kingdom. So we need to come up with new technology to build, run, and maintain these large photocatalyst panel reactors. To do this, scientists are constantly experimenting with different materials and methods to try and make the best photocatalysts and water-splitting systems. Safety is an extremely important consideration. The process of splitting water initially produces a mixture of hydrogen and oxygen gases, which must be separated to obtain pure hydrogen. When hydrogen and oxygen are combined, the mixture is highly flammable and can become explosive if not handled properly. Scientists must be extremely careful to follow all laws and regulations to keep the entire process as safe as possible and avoid dangerous accidents. One solution might be to design systems that can safely separate the hydrogen from oxygen as soon as they are produced, so a mixture is never formed. This would help to prevent fires or explosions because these gases are not explosive on their own. Finally, photocatalytic water splitting systems are still very expensive to build and maintain. Right now, it's much cheaper to generate hydrogen from fossil fuels than from water splitting. Currently, hydrogen produced from photocatalytic water splitting can cost more than hydrogen produced using methane, for example. So scientists need to figure out how to keep the costs down so that these systems are competitive with other energy sources. Otherwise, people will probably not choose to use them. The future of green hydrogen. Despite the challenges that remain, the future of photocatalytic water splitting looks bright. If we can safely scale up this technology, it could provide a virtually limitless supply of clean fuel. That would help reduce our reliance on fossil fuels and significantly cut down, can't say that word, on greenhouse gas emissions, protecting our planet and all of its inhabitants. This vision of a cleaner, greener future is what drives scientists and engineers to keep trying to develop new materials and techniques that will improve green hydrogen production. So the next time you take a sip of water, remember that this simple liquid might just be the key to powering our future. How cool is that? Okay, let us go over to some Dogo news. It's Dogo news for kids. Bomp, bomp. American ultra runner Tara Dower shatters Appalachian Trail speed record. Marcella Bonnet read this article. Back on September 21st, 2024, Tara Dower set a new speed record on the Appalachian Trail, or the AT, they're going to call it from now on, in this article, the Eastern United States. The 31-year-old American ultra runner completed the 2,189-mile trail which runs from Georgia to Maine in an incredible 40 days, 18 hours and 5 minutes. Before Towers Trek, the record was held by Kara Saab, or Sabi. It took the Belgian runner 41 days, 7 hours and 38 minutes, or about 13 hours more, to finish the trail back in 2018. To achieve this milestone, Dauer ran and hiked an average of 54 miles each day. She would set off in the dark around 3:30 a.m. and end around 8:30 to 9:30 p.m. She stopped only to eat or take 90-second naps. To save time, Dauer took just 3 showers over the entire trek, relying instead on baby wipes and fresh clothes. In her final 129 hours, with the record within reach, Dauer did not sleep at all. Yikes. The ultra runner credits her success to a crew of enthusiastic supporters. For 80% of the hike, she was accompanied by an experienced runner, or pacer. In addition to keeping her company, the pacer ensured she remained on track to beat the previous assisted fastest known time, or the FKT, record. Meanwhile, the rest of her crew, led by her mother, worked tirelessly to supply the food and resources needed to sustain her strenuous journey. This was no easy task, given that Dauer consumed around 300 calories an hour. She said, "I viewed myself as the race car, and the crew was the pit crew," she said. "So they're maintaining me, fueling me, doing whatever is needed to keep me going." Dauer used her AT record attempt to raise over $55,000 for Girls on the Run. The nonprofit is dedicated to empowering young girls through running and education. Dauer hopes her achievement will inspire women and girls to go for that tough goal, whether in running or in life. While endurance athletes like Dauer and Sabi make it look effortless, the AT, which spans 14 U.S. states, is far from easy. The trail's rocky terrain and high elevation pose significant physical and mental challenges. Approximately 75% of the people who attempt the trail fail to complete it. For those who do, the journey typically takes 5 to 7 months. The AT record is the latest in a series of impressive ultra-distance achievements by Dauer. Since taking up the sport in 2020, she has set 5 FKT records. They include the 1,175-mile Mountains to Sea Trail, the 289-mile Benton McKay Trail, and the 486-mile Colorado Trail. Next article here. Sticking with Dogo News for Kids, student-built rocket breaks 20-year-old amateur space altitude record. John Wu wrote this article. A rocket built by students at the University of Southern California, or USC Rocket Propulsion Lab, RPL, has shattered a 20-year record. Aftershock 2, launched from Nevada's Black Rock Desert on October 20th of 2024, reached an altitude of 470,000 feet. This was 90,000 feet higher than the previous amateur rocket altitude record of 380,000 feet. It was set by the Civilian Space Exploration Team's Go Fast rocket back in 2004. The 14-feet-tall Aftershock 2 broke the sound barrier within 2 seconds of launch. It reached a maximum speed of 3,600 miles per hour, 5.5 times the speed of sound, just 19 seconds after launch. This slightly exceeded the speed record set by Go Fast in 2004. While its engine burned out shortly after launch, Aftershock 2 continued its ascent. It left Earth's atmosphere, say that 3 times fast, in about 85 seconds after the launch and reached its peak altitude in 92 seconds. At this point, the rocket's nose cone detached and deployed its parachute for a safe landing in the desert. Here, it was retrieved by the eagerly waiting student scientists. Aftershock 2's success can largely be credited to technological innovations developed by the 100-person team at RPL. The rocket's titanium-coated fins and new heat-resistant paint enabled it to endure the extreme temperatures and that are generated at high speeds. Student-designed computer systems allowed real-time tracking of the rocket's position and sent back live data through the flight.
see, who is this? Operations lead Jaina Rabner said, "This was probably the coolest thing we'd ever gotten the opportunity to do. We're just college students who have homework and dishes and groceries to do, and we had just sent a rocket to space. We broke the world record and sent a rocket higher than anyone ever has." RPL was founded in 2005 to launch student-designed and built rockets into space. The student-led group first made history in 2019 when their Traveler 4 rocket became the first student-built rocket to cross the Charmaine line. This imaginary line, 328,083 feet above the Earth's surface, marks the internationally recognized edge of space. RPL's next goal is not to build rockets for higher altitudes, such as launches would require special permission. Instead, the team plans to focus on developing sounding rockets, vehicles designed to carry scientific instruments into space for research purposes. See, who is this? RPL executive engineer Ryan Kramer. He says this,
"Actually, 470,000 feet is just shy of the limit for amateur rocketry, which is 490,000 feet. Unless we want to get special clearances, we're going to have to stay under that height, but we're going to move forward in the sense of flying research payloads. We're excited to use essentially what is a sounding rocket at this point to gather data for whoever wants it." Whoever wants it.
And with that, I'm out of time. This is Bigler for Bigler's World. I'll read with you next week. Until then, bye-bye, everybody. Bye-bye.